We're calling the Senate Labor and Commerce to order. It is Thursday, the 7th of April, and it is 1:36. With us today, Senator Seekins, Senator Stevens, Senator Ellis, Senator Davis, and myself, Bundy. On our schedule today, SB 139, SB 131, SB 108, SB 145, and a House Bill 81. We'll begin with SB 139, Extension of Occupational Boards and Agencies. We have addressed this bill previously. This is one that would provide the ramp-down mechanism should a board be discontinued, and it does increase sunset dates. Do we have here someone from Senator Terry's office? Is there something more you'd like to add?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tom Maher. I'm with the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee, Senator Terrell Chair. Gene certainly looked at the amendments. We approve of the amendments, and we like the bill the way it is. And in case there are questions, we do have Jim Griffin, who is the audit manager that actually worked on this particular audit. So,
but we do have a CS that I'd like to adopt as our working document, and that's / I India.
Chairman, I'd move that we consider CS for Senate Bill number 139, Labor and Commerce, / India, as our working document.
Okay, there are, and these were proposed as changed by the administration, and just for explanation, the first change is it deletes Section 2 and inserts a new Section 2 that's amended to read as it is in the CS, and call your attention to the underlying portion. All statutory authority of the board is transferred to the department. And the note on amend was
that was the change.
Yeah. Okay. I was saying, I didn't think there was another change. But not trusting my limited memory. And the second change was to add a new section to the bill, Section 4, and it reads as we, as is in the CS. And again, this was at request of the department.
We discussed both at the last meeting. So.
Okay.
No objection.
No objection. All right. It is. And Barbara, would you like to testify? Welcome.
My name is Barbara Gabier with the Division of Occupational Licensing, and I just wanted to indicate that the department does support the CS, and it includes all the amendments that we requested.
Any questions for Barbara? If not, thank you for being here. Is there anyone else like to testify on SB 139? Seeing none, we'll close public testimony. Are there any amendments, additional amendments? Seeing none, the will of the committee.
Mr. Chairman, I move CS for Senate Bill number 139, Labor and Commerce, from committee with individual recommendations in the attached fiscal note.
And
zero.
Senator Stevens?
Yes.
Senator Davis?
Yes.
Senator Seekins?
Yes.
Senator Ellis?
Yes.
Senator Bundy.
Yes. That brings us to SB 131, the Wage and Hour Act. and we do have a CS that I'd like to adopt as our working document. It's / Foxtrot by Carver.
Chairman, I'd move... move CS for Senate Bill number 131, Labor and Commerce, / Foxtrot, as our working document.
Just for explanation.
And we have John Sidor on off-net, who will, or online, who will the CS. You with us, John?
Hello?
Yes, hi. If you'll identify yourself for the record, please.
Yes, my name is John Sidor.
And I am here speaking on behalf, or here telephonically speaking on behalf of the Anchorage Society for Human Resource Management, representing over 200 business members, as well as the Society for Human Resource Management, Alaska State Council, representing over 250 business members.
And you have CS in front of you?
Yes, I have CS, F is in Foxtrot.
All right, that's the correct one. Would you like to walk us through that, CS, please?
Sure, I can walk you walk the committee. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Sedor. I'll be happy to walk through the CS as well as answer any questions or expound on any of the testimony I gave a couple of weeks ago on the former bill. Section 1 adds computer systems analyst, computer programmer, software engineer, or other similarly skilled workers. That is a reference to a regulatory provision in the federal regulations, and what that does is to identify that, consistent with the federal regulations and the federal law under the Fair Labor Standards Act, that computer systems workers can be exempt either under the executive exemption, the administrative exemption, or there is a specific to computer systems workers hourly exemption where they are paid over $27.63 an hour, which works on a 40-hour work week over $1,000 for the week. So that's what Section 1 does. Section 2 is at the top there. This would require all exemptions to meet the 2x minimum wage test. And it's just a moving out of that. Also in Section 2, there was various discussions in the last hearing about the federal definitions. That has been clarified and stated there. I would note in passing there were comments from Barbara Huff orally and in the written testimony of Randy Carr regarding highly compensated individuals. Both of those testimonies thought it would be a good idea to add the highly compensated, which, for your information, is individuals paid over $100,000 a year. That is not included in here and does not need to be because, and this is one of the, I think, upsides of moving towards the one system for overtime for all of Alaska employers and employees, but there's no need to specifically mention highly compensated employees because that is part of the definition of administrative and executive under the federal regulations. Also, I think I've addressed everything in Section 2. Section 3, or the bottom of Section 2, I'm looking at the sectional analysis for CSSB 131 LNC. On the second page there, talks about the outside salesman and salesman who is employed on a straight-time commission basis. Neither of those have been changed from the previous draft, only moved. Section 3 also is the deletion of the supervisory capacity, which exemption does not exist under the federal system, and that has only been moved also. Same with Section 4. Section 5 specifically references the Fair Labor Standards Act, which is consistent with at least the tone of that is consistent with other provisions of the current statute where the legislature has encouraged the department to look at the federal system and regulations in determining its own regulations. And that is a quick walkthrough of the CS, and I'd be happy to address any questions or concerns.
Okay, we're looking for questions. Don't have any at this time. Thank you. I did want to point out to the committee that it's the chair's intent to have a provision in the CS that would have indicated that claimants that people who might feel they have a claim in this arena would have 6 months after the effective date to establish that claim rather than have it run out the 2 years that was in previous legislation. And I would offer that as a conceptual amendment with committee's permission to have the drafters put it in the appropriate place in the appropriate language.
So you're proposing to decrease the amount of time for a claim from 2 years to
6 months.
6 months.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Seekin.
I had already wrote myself a note that I believe that we should provide in this legislation that any claims that are out there, coit or inchoate, which could be brought that have not reached final adjudication, should be told, and probably because I'm sensitive to the fact that we have a current bill that's been going through the legislature on both sides now, where when we cited this should be the law, that we didn't sew the sack all the way shut, and we did put a certain amount of jeopardy on, unintended jeopardy on folks. So I'm willing to go along with this, with the six-month expiration rather than the standard two-year statute of limitations. But I probably would have been a little bit tougher.
Well, my thoughts were that if we don't make a change, the effective date of this legislation is really 2 years out. And trying to be reasonable and some compromise, I thought 6 months to establish a claim after this becomes law seems like a reasonable amount of time for someone to exercise their rights.
Is that 6 months from the date of separation?
6 months from the effective date of the bill.
Mr. Chairman, when you say establish, you mean bring the lawsuit or complete the lawsuit to final adjudication?
No, bring the lawsuit.
And will there be any effective notice besides just this bill passing and people ought to know what, you know, people aren't aware of what we do here. And in many cases, average folks, how would people know?
Well, I'm... a good question. I was thinking folks in the labor organizations would certainly make sure that their members know.
That doesn't really cover
not everyone.
The people we're talking about mostly here.
Well,
could we think about that some more?
I guess I could make the same argument. How would they know they have 2 years?
Mm-hmm.
They're going to... I guess they won't know the law has changed until they take a job that would fall under this law. I understand where you're trying to go, but I don't want to extend the effective date out 2 years either. Jane, where does this go after us?
Finance.
I will get a chance to address it in finance, of course, and I will think about it some more and see if there is. I don't think of a notification mechanism right now.
So did you mean you wanted to get the 6 months drafted up to incorporate, or are you trying to move this now?
I'd like to move the bill with the conceptual amendment there would be a six-month window to establish claims after the effective date, which is July 1. So there would be basically the rest of this year.
And maybe it might be just best, Mr. Chairman, to say to file an action.
File an action, yeah.
Mr. Chairman, was that a request from business owners or just something you thought we ought to do, or how did that...
Both. Some have pointed out that because of the, like Senator Seekin said, the recent experience of the retroactivity, and others have pointed out that, well, this is with the two-year proviso, it's really the effective date has moved out 2 years. And that doesn't seem to offer the resolution that folks are looking for in the bill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I support the legislation overall. I guess I understand your conceptual amendment, without some sort of more thought about notification, it'd be hard for me to support that. But so you're going to try and think that through and work on that aspect of it in finance?
Yeah, I can.
Some reasonable way.
You know, I'll withdraw that amendment, give it some more thought, and
make it in finance.
Address it in finance. So, with that, are there any other amendments? Seeing none, the will of the committee.
Chairman, I'd move that the Senate Bill 131 move on to the next committee of referral with individual recommendations.
Jane?
Senator Data?
Yes.
Senator Seekin?
Yes.
Yes.
Senator Bundy?
Yes. 131 is on its way, and we'll address that in finance. That brings us to SB 108, and I had hoped to have a CS for this bill. We have not received the CS as yet.
Then you file it, huh?
And we will, but I would like to hear the bill and hold it for the CS that we'll look forward to. And would you like to talk with us about SB 108? Well, of course. We always have options.
Mr. Chairman, maybe we could ask her if she's talked enough about SB 108 today.
You could stop if she talked enough.
He was talking to Linda Sharp, so if you're not Linda Sharp, you can...
You can answer yes or no if you're Linda Sharp.
Tell Linda Sharp to say, oh, Linda Hall, I said hello, will you?
Well, Senator Davis pointed out to me yesterday that in a very recent publication, I'm Linda Smith, so...
Oh, is that right?
Well, you know, I might answer to a variety of things.
Be flexible.
I try to be flexible and understanding, so, and I would repeat, I guess I'll say who I am now.
Yes, please do for the record.
Linda Hall, Director of the Division of Insurance. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I did my original presentation on the bill last week, and I believe there was some amount, small, of public testimony. I would like to comment on a couple areas of the bill in a little more detail. I mentioned last week, and there has been additional discussion. I've tried to reach most of the members of the committee, and because I spent 3 hours with Senator Seekins this morning, I missed a couple of you. There's been a lot of controversy over the sections, I believe there's sections 28 and 29 in the bill that are the Union Health Trust language, and I would like to talk a little bit about that. I brought this piece of this legislation to the legislative body for deliberation, for policy decision. There is already in statute a provision in the, and I am going to read it, I'm sorry, I try not to do that, that talks about, except as otherwise provided in this title, a person that provides coverage for the cost of medical care, blah, 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 is subject to this title unless the person shows that they are subject to the jurisdiction of another agency of this state or the federal government with the appropriate certificate, license, or document issued by the other governmental agency that permits or qualifies the person to provide coverage for medical care. I apologize for that, but I want to be clear that there is already statutory language that requires entities providing medical care to have oversight someplace. And if they don't have it someplace else, they would have it under Title 21. In March of last year, I sent letters to the five Union Health Trusts asking for that documentation at the request, frankly, of one of the unions. Will you check on this and determine whether you regulate us or not? We received responses, and it's taken a long time to go through those responses. Last week, one of my staff sent requests for additional information, trying to obtain the information we need to make that determination. Meanwhile, I mean, and I want that on the record because I'm not trying to do something over here that is in this bill. It's a different piece of statute. There are approximately 19,000 state employees whose health benefits are provided by Union Health Trusts. And it was my desire to have some discussion and a policy call by this body as to whether there should be some standards set up for things they should do to ensure the viability of the trust. And I've listened to the testimony that you've listened to, and I haven't received all the letters you have, but Generally, those have been shared with me to a great extent. I've not had any specific contact with people from the health trusts. I have had some contact from union members. I would like there to be consideration by this body of whether the standards, and I frankly don't think they're onerous. There are some things that have been pointed out that I'm perfectly willing to change. Examples, bond limits, if we want to talk about bond limits and those are exceedingly high, that's certainly something I think that's a potential to be flexible on. If quarterly financial statements are an onerous burden, fine. What I really feel strongly about are a financial statement that shows the assets and liabilities of the health trust. Frankly, I think most of them have that, and if they don't, they should. And two, the actuarial analysis. There have been allegations that, one, no actuary would certify various things. In fact, that is exactly what actuaries do. I actually went to a point of getting an actuarial opinion to make sure I understood what an actuary did, and I have two actuaries on my staff. They do look at the contribution rate, which is the equivalent of premium. It's not the contribution rate by the legislature to the fund. It is the contribution that is the total money necessary to fund the benefit plan. It will be a combination of the monies funded through the GF, through the budget, and what the employees are charged in addition to the money provided by the state. And it also would include an actuarial analysis of the adequacy of reserves to make sure there's adequate money set aside to pay benefits, both current and future liabilities. I think those are critical pieces. We talk about solvency regulation of a number of entities, and I think entities entrusted with the welfare, the benefits of their members provided through the their state employment should have a similar kind of protection. Those are the list in the bill of the minimum standards. There are some additional standards that generally relate to the kinds of things that we require an outside appeals process. The complaints that come to my division, some valid, some not, as are all complaints that we get. There is an appeal process, but it's very formalized in the current practice, which is arbitration or the court system. That's very intimidating to many people. I've had people in my office in tears because they're intimidated by the process, and I've tried to help them, even though I don't have any regulatory authority, to go through that process to make themselves heard. I won't continue harping on that aspect. I am willing to look at things that seem to be onerous. I've heard estimates, and I think they're probably fairly accurate, that it would cost $40,000 to $50,000 for an actuarial opinion. When I look at the millions of dollars that are in those trusts, it doesn't seem to me to be a huge amount to pay. And as I said, it's my understanding that most of the trusts do this anyway. But I think it's, again, a policy decision of the legislature to decide whether or not you think those standards should be statutory standards or not. And with that, I'll quit talking.
You mentioned state employees that are covered by union health plans. There are also private people covered by union health plans, or have they gone away?
Senator Bundy, that's one of the things that I have asked from the Union Health Trust in trying to determine the exact type of entity they are. We have some that apparently have a combination of other entities' coverage within the state employees' pieces, and I can't answer that yet until I receive the information that I've requested from those groups. The intent of the bill is not, as was originally interpreted, to cover some of the political subdivisions, municipalities, school districts, those types of entities at all. They are in a different category, and so there's no intent of looking at those. It doesn't cover, I think it's probably not an accurate term, but private unions, so to speak. Teamsters, the Teamsters Health Trust, would not come under this. Those are entities that are all regulated under ERISA, self-insured plans, and probably 60% of Alaskans covered by private insurance are actually covered under some type of self-insured plan that is actually governed by ERISA. These governmental plans fall outside of that ERISA regulation.
That was the point where I was trying to go, that they are not ERISA-covered plans. So.
That's okay. Correct.
Thank you. Other questions for Ms. Hall? No. Thank you for being with us. We have a number of people who like to testify here in Juneau. Jeffrey Hart. Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Jeffrey A. Hart. I'm a 24-year employee of the state of Alaska, currently with the Department of Transportation. I began paying dues as a member of the Public Employees Local 71 30 years ago. I have been serving as a shop steward for the past 14 years. I would like to take this opportunity to voice my concerns and share my views of Senate Bill 108, specifically Section 28 and 29. These sections speak of additional oversight of self-funded governmental plans. When I first heard of Senate Bill 108 3 days ago, and before even knowing its specifics, my initial bent was to favor the possibility of some form of regulation over Local 71's self-funded trust fund. I have recently been following the discussions relating to the underfunding of the state PERS and TERS system. I have also listened to debates as to why our nation's Social Security system is in disarray. It would seem additional oversight of our trust fund would give comfort to those who don't deal with the fund on a daily basis. However, my initial bent changed quickly. I know that even though the troubled PERS and TERS systems have been managed and regulated vigorously, their unfunded liability is causing much discomfort. Additional regulation is not always the cure-all. I have taken a stance of opposition to Section 28 and 29, as they would add extra tasks and cost to our state government, particularly to some employee who is probably already burdened with a heavy workload. Section 28 and 29 proposes additional administrative tasks to the management of our trust fund, which will decrease attention given to membership and increase costs. My union representatives have furnished me with many reasons why the regulations proposed in Sections 28 and 29 are unnecessary. They estimate $40,000 to $50,000 of additional costs annually. These costs will most likely have to be billed to the membership. I personally budget my income carefully and would not want to incur this unnecessary cost. They have informed me of several regulations already being adhered to and designed to keep our trust healthy and solvent. Local 71 members are informed through mail-outs and membership meetings as to the condition of the trust and its health plan. We believe our health plan is adequate and positioned to meet our participants' needs. We also believe we have gained the experience to improve it as needed. I have and will continue to trust my union leadership to be honest and forthright with me as they look out for my family's best interests. I believe Local 71 has and will continue to work towards the best for all of its members. I ask that you see Sections 28 and 29 of Senate Bill 108 as unnecessary and have them removed from this bill. And I thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. If you'd like to leave a copy of your written testimony with us, we'd appreciate that. Questions?
There.
Oh, very good. Thank you. All right. Thank you, Mr. Hart.
Thank you.
Chris Pace.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Chris Pace. I'm a trustee with the ASEA health plan, but I'm here this afternoon speaking on my own behalf. I'd just like to clarify some of the points that were brought up, you know, at the beginning of the hearing on this bill. To begin with, I brought excerpts from our recent Dittman Research opinion poll that was performed on our members. I believe at the previous hearing on this bill, one of our other trustees mentioned that survey, so I brought you copies of that. Page 5 of that survey is the results indicating that 75% of our members in the ASEA plan were satisfied with what's happening. And we were surprised also from that survey that 52% of our members said that they weren't interested in additional well baby coverage. Our plan on an annual basis processes about 200,000 claims a year, and about 40 of those end up being appealed to the Board of Trustees. That's 0.02%. It's not perfect, but it is a very low rate. And the appeal procedure that we use for our members in our benefit plan is pretty similar to the one that I described in the PERS discussions in the legislature here. The exception with our plan is after the Board of Trustees hear an appeal, it would go to inexpensive arbitration rather than before the Superior Court. And I'd just like to point out that, yeah, the appeals are heard by an elected Board of Trustees who share the same plan as the appellant. The claims and the appeals, they have to be adjudicated consistently and fairly across the board. Once you grant one appeal, in essence, you've changed the entire benefit plan for everybody who has a similar claim. And then the repercussions from that, there's a significant financial follow-up on that, once you've changed the plan. So the trustees have to really carefully evaluate the consequences of their decisions. And the trustees are the fiduciaries. They have the statutory authority to make changes in the benefit plan. The plan that we have for ASEA members, we started out with this about 4 years ago. We basically took it verbatim from the state's plan that covers the legislators and the staff and the other, other employees in the state. Since that time, we've made some minor modifications, improvements, clarifications around the edges. Because our group, the general government unit, is generally on the lower tier of the pay schedule for state employees, we've tried to tailor our deductibles, co-pays, and out-of-pocket limits more towards the needs of our group. And one of the major factors that we've been confronted with is controlling dramatically increasing healthcare costs. We contracted with a PPO hospital. We joined a healthcare coalition with other labor unions, municipalities, and private employers to try to keep our costs under control. And as a result of this, some of our members were unhappy about being steered to an Anchorage PPO hospital. We went to positive enrollment early on. That's a feature that I understand is going to be implemented on your plan, on the supervisors, the commissioner's plan this year. The state website estimates that nationally up to 15% of spouses and dependents may not, in fact, be eligible for benefits. When our plan did the same measure, years ago, that caused some unhappiness from our members. We've been challenged with building reserves. Currently, our plan has reserves equal to about 4 months' claims experience, and then that's in addition to other amounts that we have for incurred but not reported claims. Comparing that to the audit for the plan that you're covered under, your plan has